Good afternoon. My name is James Bailey. I am here on behalf of the appellant wife in this case. This case was start to commence on the Tuesday following Memorial Day weekend in 2009. On the Friday preceding that holiday weekend, we received two new expert reports from husband in this case. Those reports were Mr. Korda's report, which valued Mr. Greenhouse's professional business practice. Mr. Greenhouse is a licensed attorney. And Mr. Moritz's report, which purported to revalue Ms. or wife's oil and gas interests. That means that one business day prior to trial, Mr. Greenhouse tendered two new expert reports on the two most significant marital assets in this case. As the trial court found, those two assets totaled $1.8 million. And that means that we had to deal with a new reports, $1.8 million, one business day, and in that case, less than one business day prior to trial. These parties do not sit at arm's length in a domestic case. Parties to a domestic case have affirmative duties, and those affirmative duties include the duties to disclose all material information without awaiting inquiry from the other party. I raise that because our first notice of these reports was that Friday. Even though the Moritz report had apparently been ongoing for 3 weeks prior to trial, and they had and were doing ongoing work 2 weeks prior to trial. That's when the attorney became involved in this process. And yet, as recently as the Thursday, this is the Thursday preceding the Tuesday start, they didn't disclose the existence of these reports before trial.
Bailey, let me ask you a question about this new report from Mr. Moritz. It appeared that in the court's order, the court relied upon the 13% discount rate used by Mr. Moritz as being more credible than the 18% discount rate used by Mr. Nelms. Was the discount rate used by Mr. Moritz in these supplemental reports, or these late reports as you call it, the same as it was in the original reports filed by Mr. Moritz?
Candidly, I don't recall as I sit here, but I will say that's irrelevant. The discount rate is the thing that the trial court decided between the two experts, but it's what that discount rate that is applied to, which is where the prejudice arises in this case. As it relates to that prejudice, we discussed with Mr. Moritz the four key points of his valuation. The first key point was we talked with him about the gas that was in the ground. He changed the amount of gas that was in the ground in his valuation methodology. Two is we talked to him about the price that was going to be paid for the gas that was in the ground. He changed that in his methodology. The third key point in his valuation related to the costs that were incurred to pull the gas out of the ground. He changed that key point. And the first thing that we talked to him about was the comparables that he used. He changed that key point. And then finally, didn't call it a key point in the examination, but it's the number of wells that were actually valued by Mr. Moritz changed. In this case, it increased by 25. That's the magic 25 that was purportedly used as a justification for the late disclosure. And I would simply mark as an aside, one, if it was as it relates to just those 25 wells, we would sit on a different footing. If only a report on those 25 wells had been tendered, we'd be having a different conversation. But here, it's the entirety of the 272 wells. And as it relates to each of those key points, we demonstrated prejudice from the failure to disclose. When we're talking about the amount of gas that's in the ground, this is the reservoir analysis. We couldn't, one, cross-examine Mr. Moritz on the amount of gas that was in the ground. We couldn't do so because at the time that we're going through his cross-examination, he's the first witness called that Tuesday morning. At that moment, I hadn't communicated with Mr. Nelms about the substance of the report. I think the briefing makes this point clear. I didn't even know he had the report. My office had actually sent it over on Friday. I hadn't communicated with him because we didn't speak over the Memorial Day weekend. He got to take that weekend off.
Mr. Bailey, did Mr. Nelms have the report before the weekend?
Mr. Nelms testified that he received the report sometime in the preceding week. And so the only time that he could have gotten it in the preceding week was the Friday. It's my recollection, candidly, that Mr. Nelms was on vacation that week. And therefore, when I was driving to trial, the morning of trial, I was trying to get a hold of him at work so we could talk. We couldn't have any communication. So he may have had the report, but I didn't have the benefit of Mr. Nelms when it comes to cross-examining Mr. Moretz. And I am many things. I'm an attorney. I am not a petroleum engineer. I am not a geologist in this case. And so when we're talking about of gas and the amount of gas that's in the ground, I can't use the benefit of the magic language from my engineer. And I think even more important than the amount of gas, let's talk about the price that was used for that gas. We've consistently raised in this case the fact that he renegotiated the price contracts that Coleman Oil and Gas was going to receive for that. I, because of the timing of the report, wasn't able to rebut that evidence. One, now we talk about Mr. Nelms, but also I can't call other people. I can't take a deposition. I can't call up. I can't take a look at the contracts themselves. As we're presenting this evidence to the trial court, we don't know if the contracts can be renegotiated, nor even who the parties are.
Did the trial court make any findings about substantial justification or prejudice or lack of prejudice?
The trial court made no findings as it relates to substantial justification. The trial court did make findings as it relates to prejudice. I believe you can find those findings basically around page 140 on the May 26th transcript. What you will find is that the trial court found that we had been able to adequately apprehend the updated report and the revised report, and that we had had sufficient time to prepare for cross-examination and also for the testimony of our own expert. And I would suggest that finding is without any support, because at that time, we hadn't talked to our expert, and at that time, we didn't have the benefit of our expert for their cross-examination.
Mr. Bailey, okay, go ahead.
Did you ask for a continuance to give more time to review the new report?
I did not ask for a continuance, and it was not tendered to us. As we argued it, and I went through the record looking for this because I have the memory of the trial court saying there's not going to be a continuance in this case, but no one suggested that a continuance was available. We were required to try it. Moreover, I believe under the case law, the tardy report requires preclusion. They're required to show either that there's substantial justification, which they cannot. They're also required to show that there's no prejudice, and candidly, the prejudice is just manifest. I was talking briefly about price. Please, ma'am.
Oh, well, my question's a little bit related to this. So what is the significance of the court's ruling on whether the late disclosure, it would still be, the testimony and the report would be allowed, that the court's ruling occurred before your complaint of testimony that once he became a witness, once the trial proceeded? And was there a request at that point in time for the court to revisit the issue on prejudice?
I don't recall reserving the second issue as it relates to prejudice. The trial court made its findings without any qualification and with no conditionality to it. He said, I'm finding that there is no prejudice. This expert can testify as to an opinion. I believe three or four lines down in the record, the expert now gives his opinion and starts to testify from that. At that point, I believe that we had established the prejudice. Moreover, I think that the prejudice is evidence in the reports itself, because it's impossible for us to find additional information that's out there to cross-examine this expert on, to talk to the third parties. So, for example, one of the things that's raised specifically in the briefing is the change in costs. Mr. Moretz testified that the costs would be decreasing over time because water would come out of the wells. You can hear me try to cross-examine him a little bit about that. Because we don't have the actual documents themselves, it's not until Mr. Nelms's testimony that we know that's false. And at that point, we don't have the ability to go out and to bring in the third-party witnesses to say, no. These specific wells have a discharge permit, so water's irrelevant. And this is not a justification for decreasing costs. Simply put, at the time that the trial court enters its order finding an absence of prejudice, there is prejudice which has been established simply by a review of the reports. Moreover, the burden's not on us. Under the Todd versus Bear Valley case, the burden is on them to show an absence of prejudice. And I'm sorry, this is 5 hours before trial. I understand that I've got a three-day Memorial Day weekend. I got young kids. I've got a life. I've got the ordinary preparation for trial. That's what my intention was to be working on Friday. It's impossible 5 hours before trial to reconstruct an expert's examination. I would submit as a matter of law that's untimely. And if you look at the cases in this area, you can find situations where the Court of Appeal has said 21 days, that's enough time. You can go out 21 days from now, and we think you can get it. But 5 hours followed by the Memorial Day weekend, it's just not going to happen. I mean, I'm sorry. I don't believe
that's going to happen. I want to remind you, you're about 4 minutes.
Thank you. I also want to focus in on the comparables for a moment, because you can see as we discussed that, how can I possibly test the comparables aspect of his examination? We know that he didn't bring his file to trial. We also know from the evidence that we elicited from Mr. Moritz that we had previously asked for his file. They didn't update it. So I have nothing to test his comparable transactions for as we proceed to trial. I'm going to move from this issue very quickly into the second primary issue that we've addressed, which relates to the separate property claim. In this case, husband brought at least two assets into the marriage. He brought his Dean Rauscher account, and he brought a law firm practice with Holland Evans. With respect to the Dean Rauscher account, he brought a pension account, and candidly, I can't remember which one it is. When he left Holland Evans, he then rolled it into Dean Rauscher. The Dean Rauscher account was acquired during the course of the marriage. Under 1410.113(4), a couple of things. One is that property was acquired during the marriage. That's the day he acquired the Dean Rauscher account. Under subsection 4, any increase in the value of that account is marital per se. That's the way we define marital property. Under the Burford case, we know that you're not entitled to offset losses with gains. And so we established the value on the date he acquired that asset. Any increase we know is marital property.
Mr. Bailey, does sub 2B have any impact on this? Is this being money in exchange for?
There's no doubt that at the date it's acquired, it's actually exchanged for. That is an exchange transaction. But what is acquired is 100. The fact that it may have been 125 and then shrunk down doesn't change the fact that only the 100 can be acquired on that date. That's the same issue that we have with the law firm. We know that he had a separate property interest in Holland Evans on the date of marriage. We have a value for what that is. What we don't have a value for is if there's any separate property interest in his law practice, his new law practice with Murray Frank, Greenhouse, List, and Lippitt. We don't know what that value is. We can't ascertain whether it's increased or decreased in value, and therefore it's inappropriate to say that any component of that is separate because it's all presumed to be marital. And there's some really good reasons to think that. One, track the tangible value from Holland Evans value into the Murray Frank value. You can't because it's spent, it's gone somewhere else. And the intangible value, there's an intangible value, a goodwill value that's associated with the Holland Evans practice. You can't say that's the same intangible value for the Murray Frank practice. You can say that Mr. Greenhouse has a personal goodwill and that he brings that from place to place. Colorado doesn't recognize personal goodwill, and his personal goodwill was never valued. I'd like to reserve the remainder of my time. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Your Honors. Let me start with the first issue addressed by Mr. Bailey with regards to the disclosure, the supplemental disclosure. By the way, this is a supplemental disclosure. We're not talking about initial disclosure. As the record showed, there was no dispute that there was timely disclosures made back in January. And even a rebuttal report that was issued by Mr. Moritz. So this was, in fact, the third report that had been received from Mr. Moritz. The trial court has considerable discretion with respect to evaluating these situations under the Todd v. Bear Valley decision. And we think in this case the court took a considerable amount of time to consider all the factors that existed here and what went on. And I think the court did find that that there was justification and that there was a lack of prejudice. And I'll refer to a few things here in a second. There was a combination of factors that the court looked at here that were very significant. As the court's probably well aware on its own, and this was discussed in the record, the economic conditions in the spring of 2009 were extraordinary. You had a situation where the economy was going into recession, and further, as discussed by the experts, there was a significant drop in natural gas prices. So what was happening is that suddenly, in the few months before this hearing in May of 2009, both experts were finding that they had different economic circumstances, and there was a significant reductions in the value, the values by both experts. The Weiss expert significantly amended his report, reducing his values 20 days before hearing from a value of $1.3 down to $835,000. And this, again, this was all part of what was going on in an economy that was changing quickly and changing right before the hearing. The other thing that occurred, and this was discussed in the brief, is that Wythe did not produce information related to the 20, it was either 25 or 30 wells until 30 days prior to the, less than 30 days, it was on April 29th, about 25 days or so prior to the hearing. This is all some of this information was information that was available in late 2008. It simply wasn't produced by Wythe, despite outstanding requests for this information. So significant additional information was provided to the husband 25 days before the hearing, and this required Moritz to evaluate this additional information and come up with these values. Again, Wythe's experts didn't even address these wells. So Wythe was presenting information that failed to include 25 significant wells. There was approximately 400, the record showed $400,000 of additional money that the Wythe had put into these wells that were reflected in these 25 additional wells. Colorado law under 1410.113.5 requires that the values be as of the date of the hearing, and the court made a note of that specifically in identifying justification and saying that in a situation like this, that you have to have reports that show values as of the date of the hearing, and in these unusual economic times, that required that these opinions be given much closer to the hearing than normal. That's why Wythe's expert did a report 20 days before the hearing. Again, the economic circumstances were changing, and again, the additional burden on our expert was these additional 25 wells that had to be evaluated in those 20 days.
Mr. Bailey, could you go ahead and address the prejudice? I'm so sorry, Mr. Greenhouse.
Yes.
Could you address what Mr. Bailey was pointing out as far as prejudice and that the court's findings were erroneous on prejudice?
Your Honor, I think that what the court found was that someone who read the very first report could easily comprehend and analyze the new report, and the court went through and said the methodologies used to arrive at the values were set forth in the original report, and the methodologies didn't change. Mr. Moritz was examined in detail on this issue by both counsel, and he explained how his methodologies were the same in both reports. I don't remember, in response to an earlier question, I don't remember if the discount rate was identical, but I know that Mr. Moritz was testifying that his methodologies were just the same. And therefore, somebody who had seen the original report could easily comprehend and analyze the new report, and the court found that. again, Mr. Moritz testified that the changes in the report were primarily driven by these price drops. Mr. Bailey makes a lot out of the comparables, but frankly, what was going on was that the comparables were that the parties had used 6 months or 4 months earlier were no longer valid comparables. The both parties were looking at different comparables because you had to look at new prices, new information, and so that was all stuff that was driven by these price drops, and again, that's what necessitated these changes.
So finding that a new report is easy to comprehend necessarily mean, though, that the other side can garner some sort of evidence to contradict the report in 5 hours' time? I mean, just because you understand it doesn't necessarily relate to time to rebut.
Well, Your Honor, I think there's a couple things. First of all, the report was provided the Friday before, and I realize that is close to beforehand. But the other thing is, during the hearing, the court specifically said, I'm going to make sure Mr. Nelms has enough time, and agreed to basically allow Mr. Nelms' testimony to be a few days later to give him plenty of time to analyze the situation. The court made a specific note of that, stated that in the record, and I think I referred to that in my brief. And if you look at the record, and I try to identify some of this in my brief, Mr. Nelms did address these issues. There's extensive testimony from Mr. Nelms where he's gone through and he talks about this stuff and he addressed these issues. So by the time Mr. Nelms testified, I think we were now 3 or 4 days from the time the report had been submitted.
I recall seeing in the record where the court specifically gave Mr. Nelms, say, an afternoon to do more preparation. But what I'm confused about, was that before or after Mr. Moritz testified and was cross-examined?
I believe Mr. Nelms was present during the testimony, and I think it was after he testified. Yeah, because Mr. Moritz did testify initially, and then Mr. Nelms testified subsequently.
So Mr. Bailey didn't have the benefit of Mr. Nelms' additional work at the time he cross-examined Mr. Moritz?
I believe that, I wish I had checked this, Your Honor, because I think Mr. Moritz was brought back.
Okay.
But I don't want to misstate that to the court. I'm not 100% sure. I know that Mr. Moritz was on the stand several times.
Okay. We can check it.
Okay. Your Honors, I'd like to next turn to the issue regarding the law firm, husband separate interest in the law firm. There's in the brief by wife, she argues that it was not proven that the value from Hall and Evans was transferred into the value of the new law firm. As identified in our brief, the only testimony on this issue was from Mr. Cordes, stating that that his value in Hall and Evans is determined by the excess earnings method, was in fact transferred into the new firm. And all of the only evidence on this was from me as husband and from Mr. Cordes talking about how all of the assets, basically husband's practice being moved from one law firm to another. And there was significant discussion about his entire book of business, his clients, his experience, his reputation, his goodwill, all being moved from one law firm to another. And it was Mr. Cordes' testimony that was unrebutted that this was essentially an exchange of an asset, a transfer of an asset, if you will, an asset that clearly existed prior to the marriage into a new asset. And again, it is my understanding, and our understanding is discussed in the brief, that if you have a transfer of one asset or an exchange from one asset to another, that the value that's relevant under 1410.113 is the value at the time of the marriage versus the value at the time of the hearing. And there was a clear value given, unrebutted, of the value at the time of the marriage and a value at the time of the hearing. And the court found that was because there had been a clear move from the practice from Hall and Evans to the new law firm, that those were the values that were relevant. And the court did find that the additional $166,000 in value was marital property in accordance with 1410.113.
Mr. Greenhouse, let me ask you about subsection 2B. Does the in exchange for apply here, and that there had to be shown some tracing of the Holland Evans, let's say the tangible assets, let's talk about those, the tangible assets to the tangible assets of the new firm, did there have to be some tracing to show it was in exchange for?
What Mr. Cordes said was that he believed that the value that's being valued under the excess value method is the personal goodwill, the practice, and that the tangible and intangible values are simply methods used to get to the value of the excess earnings. And so the tracing is what's happening to that practice, what's happening to that that lawyer's ability to move his ability to earn excess earnings from one place to another. And so Mr. Cordes's argument was that was the tracing. You do have what is being valued, which is the excess earning capacity, that practice, that client base, that experience, that reputation is being moved from one place to another. And that's what's being valued, that's what's being transferred. And so Mr. Cordes testified that is the entire value. I know that they make an issue out of the capital account, but Mr. Cordes testified that the capital account is not part of the excess earning method. The capital account is a separate account that law firms will have where there basically are cash that's set aside that a lawyer will get when he leaves the practice. That is a separate asset, and that asset standing alone, if husband had taken that, if I had taken that and was holding it, yes, that would be separate property. In this case, that property was not kept separate. But what Mr. Cordes testified is that's not what's being valued. What's being valued is the excess earning, all of those other components, and the capital account had nothing to do with it. It was not what was being valued by Mr. Cordes. It was not what was being, it's not what he was looking for to be transferred into the new firm. Your Honor, the final point that I would make on this is that if under 1410.113, if the court doesn't find that there was a transfer of the from one asset to the from one firm to the other firm, the court can consider any increase or decrease in the value of husband's entire separate property. So if the court finds that all or part of husband's interest in Holland Evans was not transferred to the new firm, then the matter should be remanded for the court to consider under 1410.113.1d whether or not there should be an equitable adjustment for the value of Holland Evans that was somehow lost in this transaction. Again, the undisputed testimony and the testimony from Mr. Cordes was that this property was all transferred into the firm, but if it was not and was somehow dissipated or lost, I think that then the court could consider whether or not there should be an equitable adjustment for the loss of that asset. Just very quickly, I'm going to address one of the issues that we raised on appeal. Our issue number four was whether the court erred in creating an asset and allocating to husband the $884,123 amount as a 2009 bonus income. This ties somewhat to this issue about the value of the law firm. The court provided no explanation in this case of the $84,123 asset allocated to husband, labeled it as a 2009 bonus income. And again, this is another situation where Mr. Cordes had looked at this asset. He had evaluated it as part of his value for the firm, considered it in the value that he came up with, and the court used Mr. Cordes's value, which was done under the excess earning method, and then the court added, without explanation, an additional $84,123, which was a distribution that had been made to husband in the first quarter. Our argument is that this is a duplication of something that's already been valued by the court. And again, Mr. Cordes's testimony was that this was not an extraordinary distribution. This was consistent with this client having periodic large, this was from one specific client of the firm having periodic large payments, and that there was nothing extraordinary about this payment. I guess my time is up, so thank you very much.
Mr. Bailey, you have about 48 seconds left.
I'll talk fast.
Okay.
May it please the court, some very quick points as we relate to the issue. One, methodologies that we're not quite catching what the point is. Trial court found that what we have is new opinions, new data. We can't test those new opinions or that new data given the time that it was given to us. The second primary report relates to natural gas as a commodity. And had they merely changed the pricing structure because it's a commodity, we'd be having a different conversation. If they went from 5 down to 2.5, they didn't do that. They changed the price that CIG, Coleman Oil and Gas, was going to get for it. They changed the underlying contracts. The other thing that we argued, Husband was deferring income from 08 to 09. And this distribution, which was owed to Husband, if you take a look at the books and records of Husband's law practice, it says he received $135,000. He didn't receive it. His bank records or his checks themselves say that he received $51,000. And so it's the deferral of that income that we picked up both before and after 2008, and that's the source proper of that distribution. Thank you. I see my time has expired.
Thank you, counsel. Both of your arguments will be very helpful to us, and this matter will stand submitted, and opinion will issue in due course. Thank you.